Horror, the official podcast of iHorror.com. This is episode 111, otherwise known as season 6, episode 12. I am your host, James J. Edwards, and with me, as always, is your other host, Jacob Davison. How are you doing, Jacob?
Fine.
Well, all right. also with us, as always, is your other host, John Correa. How are you doing, Correa?
Fine.
I was expecting that.
I just wanted to undercut it for once.
Yeah. Jacob's got places to go.
Yeah. Let's make this quick.
Let's jump right into it. The big release this week is The Last Voyage of the Demeter. Have we all seen it?
Of course.
I was at a pre-screening with the director Andre Overdahl and some of the producers in person. And, you know, it's just wild to me because I've been waiting for this movie for damn near 20 years. Like, this shit was announced when I was in high school.
Yeah.
It's been a long journey.
Which is interesting because I did see someone asked him, was this movie originally a part of the Dark Universe? Remember that? Remember when Universal tried launching that?
Yeah, the Dark Universe.
And he was like, nah, this was with DreamWorks. And I was like, yeah, I know that they were trying to do some Dracula shit, but like, I feel like this idea of doing an entire movie just about the Demeter, that's been in the works forever, you know?
Yeah.
Well, if you're not familiar with the original Dracula book, the Last Voyage of the Demeter is based on one chapter in the book of Dracula, and it's the Captain's Log chapter, and it basically covers Dracula's voyage from Romania to London. Yeah. And he gets shipped there in a crate of dirt from his hometown or from his home country. And in the book, the ship runs aground with no crew and a dog jumps off of it. Yeah. And The Last Voyage of the Demeter is what happened on that voyage. What'd you guys think?
I really loved it. I enjoyed it. At the Q&A, they even said originally they had pitched it as Alien on a boat with Dracula.
Yeah.
And I think it delivered on that premise. That's
pretty much what it is. Yeah. When you imagine and you read the Captain's Log chapter of Dracula, what you imagine is like a slasher, which is basically what Alien is, but on a boat, a slasher on a boat. Yeah. And yeah, it does deliver on that. What about you, Korea?
I loved it. I'm seeing not a lot of discourse, but I'm seeing a lot of people like there's the jokes of, oh, it's Dracula on the boat. How scary can it be? It's like, dude, that's like honestly one of the most harrowing parts of the actual book. Like if you read the book,
because
it's all through Captain's Log and there's all these like people
it's
are
like found stuff. Footage.
Yeah.
People just go missing.
Yeah.
He's like, he's all, you know, we're having to do single watches because we don't have enough to double up, you know?
Yeah, dude, it's terrifying. And usually like in the movies, because of budget and stuff, they allude to it or they like show like Dracula get packed up and then him arrive or something. Or in Coppola's Dracula, you know, there's that great like montage sequence and where he's like wolfing out kind of like monstrous. There's always like this allusion to it, but like, it's never fully explored. So I was stoked about it. Yeah.
It's funny you mentioned that because there is a slightly expanded upon version in the unofficial Dracula adaptation, Nosferatu, by F.W. Murnau, which at the Q&A, Overdahl was even talking about that was a major influence on them for the movie, both in kind of the style and also the creature design for their version of Dracula, who is not like Francis Ford Coppola's Dracula or Gary Oldman Dracula. He's very Max Schreck Dracula.
Yeah. He's Murnau. He's Nosferatu. Yeah.
I was going to say, and even with that, he's much more primal, much more creature, which is always like one of the best parts of which is why I like the Demeter part, because this is just Dracula in pure predator mode. This isn't him like trying to like suave or trick people with words. This is him like, all right, I am purely hunting these people, but I'm also keeping myself away so that no one's aware that it's me for as long as possible until it's too late.
Here's the thing. I mean, I'm not as high on this movie as you two are. I loved the first half of it. You know, the whole like setup but it gets to a point where, in my opinion, it kind of jumps the shark. And I kind of the second half, first of all, I don't think this needed to be a 2-hour movie. And the second half for me did drag. I loved the first half. I also loved the vampire design. But my problem with the vampire, it's played by Javier Botet, who can do a lot cooler shit than he did in this movie. They didn't have the vampire do all that cool Javier Botet shit. You know, he was, I don't know. I think maybe I was expecting too much, but the second half of it kind of let me down a little bit. I was expecting Alien on a boat, and it pretty much was, but there's things, you know, one thing I did like about it is it is a little bit of a spoiler, but if you watch the trailer or anything, someone told me it was in the trailer. Don't think I've started watching trailers. There's a woman on the boat, and women on boats back then were considered bad luck. So it was like a bad omen. Yeah. Well, she was there again, a little bit of a spoiler, fast forward a few seconds if you don't want to hear it. She's there for Dracula to feed on during the journey. And she kind of gets rescued. And so it's kind of a sympathetic version of Dracula, because he didn't mean to kill all the people on this boat, but his food was taken away, so he had to. And that kind of falls in with the Universal Monsters. To me, the Universal Monsters are sympathetic characters, with the exception of the Invisible Man. The Invisible Man is just an asshole.
Well,
nah, the Invisible Man's that you cannot defend the Invisible Man not being an asshole.
Not the Invisible Man. That's one of the reasons why I love it. He's just a deliciously villainous character, and that's why he's my favorite. But I would disagree on the sympathetic part of Dracula. I feel like his food was taken away, and so it was kind of like, oh, you took my food away? Well, fuck you, you know? And like that, because like
there's a little bit of vengeance in there. Yeah.
He was siphoning off of her and like keeping her alive to take a little bit, to go from that to just like eating like a 6-man crew and all the animals on board. Like that's a bit overkill. That's a bit of a petty revenge, which again, I love a petty villain. So, I agree. I think
it's nuclear revenge, what he did, not petty.
I would say the movie does not really paint him in a sympathetic light in any sense, especially because, I mean, even if he just had that girl, like he was still draining the life from this poor girl for an entire, voyage like that. So, you know, fuck Dracula.
Yeah. Fuck Dracula. that's the thesis of all this. But I agree. I think it could have been like 10, 15 minutes shorter. You know,
I think it could have been 40 minutes shorter. This could have been an 80 minute movie.
No,
it's one chapter in the book.
Although I think they did a pretty decent job expanding on it, but I do they probably could have been shortened a little bit.
Yeah.
Another one of my issues is, with the exception of the captain and the doctor, you don't really care about any of these characters. You know, you care about the little kid because he's a little kid, but you know, you don't even care about the girl that much, you know? So, I guess for a movie that long, I think they should have developed the characters more so you care about them. Besides the first mate, the captain, the doctor, you know, and the girl, the other crew members, they were interchangeable. I didn't even know who was who, you know.
Well, David S. Melchin's character stood out.
He was the first mate.
Yeah.
Yeah, he was the first mate, so you knew who he was. Yeah.
Oh, he was awesome as always. Like, he was anytime he's in something, he's like the standout. But
there was a little bit of character there, because in the equivalent of the cop who's retiring in 2 days, this is the captain's last
journey. It's Liam Cunningham from like Dog Soldiers.
Yeah. And he says at the beginning, he's like, this is going to be my last voyage, and I'm recommending you to be captain. So it's like, the first mate is going to get the ship, so he wants this journey to go well. And the captain wants this journey to go well because he doesn't want his last journey to be this disaster. So,
and they want the bonus pay.
Yeah, the rest of the crew wants the bonus pay, too. Yeah. So there are reasons why they didn't just pull into a port and say, not kill that thing. You know,
There was a lot of really good, because you gotta work the logic. Like, how was he able to hide out so long before they realized? How was Dracula able to get all these people? And I think they did a really good job with the logistics of all that, until there's one scene where someone is behind a door and a hole is broken through the door. It's kind of a Shining moment, right? And then he kind of sticks his arm through, but then doesn't open the door. And then others come up and they're like banging on the door, being like, open the door, open the door. And I'm just sitting there going, put your arm through the hole, put your arm through the hole. And no one's putting their arm through the hole. And then someone tries to put their arm through the hole, but they don't try hard enough. And they're like, oh, I can't reach the door handle. Make the hole bigger, make the hole bigger, put your arm through the door. That's my one frustration with the movie, is just sitting there going, put your arm through the hole. But yeah, I still had a lot of fun with it. It was a great take on it. I would watch a sequel to it, to be honest, like The Devil of the Demeter or something. Like, I want to see that Dracula unleashed on London.
It's funny, at the Q&A, Overdahl even mentioned that, remember, Dracula takes the boat back to Transylvania later on in the book. So, hey.
How? With how it landed?
It was wrecked, yeah.
Well, no, he takes a different boat, because remember, he goes back to Transylvania at the end of the book.
In the book, the ship just kind of goes into port with no one on it. In the movie, it gets wrecked.
No. I mean, like, it's a different boat. Like, at the end, he takes another boat in order to get back to Transylvania, because remember, Jonathan and Van Helsing are chasing after him. He goes back to Transylvania.
Mm-hmm. But speaking of the cast of the Demeter, the young boy in that movie was also in another horror movie that came out this summer, Cobweb.
Oh, yeah. I saw that.
Did you guys see Cobweb?
Yeah, I just watched it a couple days ago. I rented it.
Yeah. You know why? It's because they released it the same weekend as Barbie and Oppenheimer in like the most limited amount. Like, I'm in L.A. and there was three theaters playing it here, all like 11 p.m. showings. That's it. It was such a limited release, and what a travesty to do that, because it was a fun movie, like very atmospheric, very, I think Jacob, you and I talked about it a little bit earlier, and it's a Halloween movie, so like, yeah. Why release it in the middle of July?
Yeah, it's the same with the Haunted Mansion. Why would you release this in July? It's a Halloween movie.
I don't get that about Haunted Mansion. I don't know why they did it. It's a Halloween movie.
It's ridiculous. Like, is it, they're both even set around Halloween, for God's sake.
Yeah, it's weird. But like, Cobweb, though, at this movie, I'd say go in as blind as possible. So Jay's whole thing about not watching trailers, honestly, like, the trailer doesn't give away a whole lot, which is good. But like, there's enough of like, it's just going in blind, because there's a lot of weirdness going on. But Woody Norman is the child actor who was in Last of the Demeter, this, and he was also in Come On, Come On with Joaquin Phoenix. So that kid's blowing up right now. But it's also got Lizzie Kaplan and Anthony Starr. And I don't know if it's just because of Anthony Starr's performance in The Boys, but like, immediately, like, seeing him and like pop up on the screen, it's like red flag. All right, that guy's
doing yeah, some no, that shit. Was a good casting choice in that regard. And also, it looked to be very practical effects oriented, because, again, not going into spoilers, but there is some pretty cool and creepy effects throughout the movie. And it is like genuinely very eerie type of movie, because it kind of has this sort of Guillermo del Toro dark fantasy horror vibe to it. It's unfortunate that, you know, it was so limited in its release in theaters, because yeah, I mean, it's fine seeing it at home, but I do wish I had the chance to have seen it on a big screen.
Yeah, so like, I mean, it's out on Blu-ray. Well, it's on VOD right now for like $7. It's well worth it. It's on Blu-ray in September, but yeah, I mean, I'm gonna add it to my Halloween rotation. And I'd love to hear from Samuel Bodin on what happened with the release, because it was announced in 2022 that it was going to be made. So it's been worked on for 3 years. And Samuel Bodin did the Marianne show for Netflix a few years back. If you ever watched that horror series, that was really good, too. But yeah, Cobweb's awesome. Yeah, I'm going to champion. I think that's this year's Empty Man, where it's just like, whoa, this is good. Why is this getting just kind of like bleh, out there, you know, like. Lionsgate, I get it. Lionsgate is trying to, you know, save room for Saw X in October. So maybe that's why they're
horror
like,
our fans got enough love for both.
Yeah, dude. Like,
they didn't, I don't think they hired any PR for Cobweb either. They did it themselves. So,
yeah, no, I mean, like, most of what I heard about it was either secondhand or for trailers. It was not very marketed.
Yeah. Speaking of 2020, like, You like that segue? There's a couple of movies from 2020 that I caught up with that I'm not sure if you guys have seen. The first is The Stylist. Either you guys see The Stylist?
Oh, I saw that.
Yeah. Okay. This movie is pretty freaking awesome. It's kind of like Maniac, but with a female anti-hero, I guess. It's about a hairstylist who is kind of... She's kind of like an American Psycho kind of killer.
I've never heard of Maniac being the story of an anti-hero.
Joe Spinell, wasn't exactly what I would call an anti-hero in that
one. It's actually more the girl in The Stylist is an anti-hero more than Spinell. And she's played by I'm going to butcher this name, Najara Townsend, who was also in Contracted. She's the one who plays The Stylist, and she's more of an anti-hero, but yeah, not so much Spinell. But this movie, it's crazy. And Bria Grant plays a woman who's getting married. And so she asks the stylist to do her hair for the wedding. And the stylist is like, at first she's like, oh, I don't do weddings. And, you know, that puts up like a little flag in you. You're like, oh, why doesn't she do weddings? It's so much fun. It's so much fun for slashers. And the other one that I caught up with that's a little older, Don't Tell a Soul. Real generic type. Have you seen it?
That's the one with Rainn Wilson. Yeah.
Yes. Yes. Yeah. It's real total generic sounding title. But what it is these two teenagers they break into a house that's being termite tented, and they steal a bunch of money, and they get chased away by a security guard. And as they're running through the woods, the security guard falls into a well that is a sealed off well that is covered with leaves. And he's played by Rainn Wilson. So he's now at the bottom of this well and he can't get out. And one of the kids feels kind of guilty about this, but the other one is like, oh, no, let him freaking starve. Let him freeze.
If he gets out, then we'll be in trouble. So we're fine. Like, just leave him down there.
And the other kid starts like bringing him water and a blanket and, you know, and it's a really interesting, and it goes somewhere that I did not expect it to. Yeah. But it's another one of those little crazy movies that I just happened to catch up with.
I think that was one of those ones. Kind of similar to Cobweb, where I was like, why is no one talk about this? Like, it's a solid little movie with like some very good atmosphere, very good, like Rainn Wilson, his character is very interesting. And like, especially as it like develops and like the relationship between with him and the kids, it's like, it's very, yeah, it's a solid little thrill. I think it's on like Hulu or something, but
it's a real generic name. So
yeah, that too.
Yeah. Don't Tell a Soul is kind of, you know, I think with, if they had, I don't know what you would name it other than that, but if it had a different title, it might have done, you know, gotten a little more attention at the time.
It's no Hider in the House, you know, no one could ever top the naming.
Yeah,
of that,
no, you hear Hider in the House, you know what you're getting.
Yeah.
And conversely on Underscored Movies, but oppositely, this had a very interesting title. I revisited a movie that I was a big fan of in high school that got a Blu-ray release from Terrorvision called Some Guy Who Kills People by Jack Perez. Have either of you seen it?
No. What's it about?
Yeah. Is it about a bear on cocaine?
But no. It's it's Some Guy Who Kills People. That's the title. And it's actually very interesting because it's about it's kind of a more grounded slasher kind of mystery thriller, dark comedy. But yeah, so basically it's about this guy that's been in a mental asylum for years because he was horribly traumatized in a beating by the local basketball team in this small town. And he was a former comic book artist, and he has to resort to working at an ice cream store. And when he comes back, he's like trying to rebuild his life. Like, he has to move back in with his mom, who's played by Karen Black, and is verbally abusive to him. And the people that beat him so badly, he ended up having a mental breakdown, start getting killed off one by one. But it seems like it could be him, but there's like a lot more to it. And also Barry Bostwick has a great role as the local sheriff investigating the murders. And yeah, it's it's just very interesting because it does kind of take a closer look at kind of the revenge slasher killing type of plot, but kind of puts it over its head. And it's really funny. It's got some great kills. It was just one of those like independent horror comedies from like the 2010s, came out 2011, that I feel like didn't get enough attention.
I've never heard of it. I mean, not that I remember. The guy who kills people, is that what it's called?
Some guy who kills people. Some guy who kills people. That's it. That is one of my favorite horror movie titles, though.
Did you guys see Teenage Mutant Ninja Turtles, Mutant Mayhem?
Yes.
Jay.
I love that movie.
You got to see it. It's fucking good. It's the new TMNT movie, right? This one, they go back and they really go back to the teenage aspect of it, and which I
like. They even have teenage actors play the Teenage Mutant Ninja Turtles for once.
These are actually like 13, 14 year old kids. Yeah. And they did. There's so much good.
Is it claymation or is
No, it's actually CG animation, but it's kind of like that Spider-Verse thing where like they really stylize it. So it kind of looks like it's a kind of a weird cell shaded claymation type of style, but it's also got this kind of like 80s comic book style where like the people are kind of weird looking and like everything is kind of stylized.
The animation is phenomenal, and and it's not just like the character design, but the story and the vibe, everything is, it really does feel like the perfect blend of like the original Eastman and Lord comics that were black and white, very brutal, and the 90s cartoon, which was very comical and vibrant.
Oh, and also the anime influences of the 2003 version.
Yeah. I thought this was like a great, like, all right, we're going to take everything that's been done before and like rework it into our own voice. And it was phenomenally done. They made some few changes to the origin that I thought worked really well, you know.
I got Jackie Chan as Master Splinter,
which was great. It's always great. Jack. I mean, if you have an old mentor, it's got to be Jackie Chan. But I'm glad he also and part of the origin, they kind of took away all the stuff about clans and how, like, you know, they're descendants in this clan with the ninjas and, like, you know, ultimately going against Shredder. Instead, they lean more into, no, they were just these animals that were mutated and like they learned all their ninja skills through like YouTube videos and VHS tapes. So it's really goofy, the montage. You see Master Splinter with like a mustache and big hair and stuff, but and the soundtrack is like all 90s New York hip hop for the most part. There's like some old Dirty Bastard in there, some De La Soul, and they got Andy Up, and of course they included the ninja rap from Teenage Mutant Ninja Turtles
too. Yeah, Ice,
go ninja, go ninja, go. Yes.
But that wasn't even the best needle drop. The best needle drop, they have an entire chase sequence set to the internet version of Heya, you know, like the old He-Man one from early internet days. And I said, hey, yeah. And what's great is they work it in and the chase starts and then like all of a sudden the chameleon, I can't remember his name,
Mondo Gecko, played by Paul Rudd.
Yeah, Mondo Gecko, who's like a surfer stoner character played by Paul Rudd, great. And the song basically kicks off with him going, hey, what's going on? As the chase sequence starts, it's so.
I also really like this fight scene they have set to No Diggity.
Yeah.
It's like so they have four different fights, but integrate them into one fight animation set to No Diggity, and it is incredibly animated.
Yeah, I'm just so excited for like children to leave the theater and go, I want to listen to the soundtrack, because like there's a playlist on Amazon, and the first song on it is Andy Up, and so I could just imagine just like a bunch of little kids leaving the theater going, Andy Up, yap that fool, Andy Up, kidnap that fool. It's the perfect timing. Oh man, that fills my heart with joy.
Yeah. Also, I was at yet another revival screening of Dude Bro Party Massacre 3 at Alamo Drafthouse, which makes it my second this year.
Of just that one movie?
Yes.
How many times have you seen it now, do you think?
Probably like...
Check your Letterboxd.
Well, that's the thing. I saw it before I had Letterboxd, so it's probably more like 10 or 12 times, maybe.
Is that more than Mandy? Was it Mandy at 8?
You know, honestly, I can't keep track.
Yeah,
But you know, it's just such a fun movie to see with a crowd, though, and also like all the 5 Second Films guys were there, and I even got a VHS copy of Jupiter Party Massacre 3 that they just struck, so now I've got it on Blu-ray and VHS as it was meant to be, because you know the whole shtick is that it's like in a VHS kind of style with like 4:3 and like crappy quality. And yeah, no, it's just still one of my favorite kind of crowd horror comedies as of recent, because like every time I see it, you know, even, especially at Alamo, like just big laughs from the audience, a lot of shock casts at like the crazy shit. It's just such a fun movie.
I could see that working well with a crowd. You know, there's some movies where it's like, that's pretty good. And then you see it a second time with like a crowd and you're like, oh, wow, that's so much funnier than I thought it was, you know?
Yeah, no, it definitely works better with a crowd. It's like just that kind of effect.
I'll go to the next one with you. How's that? If there's another repertory screening. Apparently, there's multiple happening in a year.
The last one was in January, so who knows? But either way, whenever it plays, I got to be there.
Going back to animation, I've been binging my. There was a deal on iTunes a few months back with the DC Animated Universe for ridiculous price, like $8 for like 20 movies. So
you messaging me about the continuity with
that. That's another thing. But Korea gave me the order that I should watch these in. So I started watching them like that. And I tell you, the funnest ones so far, I'm about halfway through, a little more than halfway through the list that you gave me. The funnest ones are the Teen Titans ones, I think. They're like, this isn't the Teen Titans I remember from my youth with like Aqualad and Kid Flash and Speedy. These are like Blue Beetle is one of them. Raven, of course, Robin is there, but it's like different Robins. But my favorite character is Beast Boy.
Yeah.
And my favorite thing that he does, he's fighting a demon. And I'm sorry, I'm laughing. He turns into a kangaroo and he jumps up in the air and then turns into an elephant
and just plops on him.
On the demon.
That's one way to settle on that.
Oh man.
That is so awesome. My second favorite thing that Beast Boy does is turn into a goat and just start ramming people.
Yeah. You got to love the randomness of Beast Boy, and like you got to have a little bit of camp with that because he just turns into animals, you know?
But it was funny because like Korea said, I messaged him about the continuity. All of a sudden, it's like I got to Justice League Dark, and all of a sudden, Hawkman is there,
yep.
And it's not Hal Jordan, it's John Stewart as the Green Lantern. And I'm like, oh, did I miss a movie or something? And he's like, oh no,
the continuity isn't the best, but there's still a lot of fun. And those animated ones are based off of like the New 52 when they rebooted DC like 2 or 3 reboots ago. So the lineups are and character design, and especially when you get to like the death of Superman and Reign of Superman, it's more based off of that, which is good. It's much better than the first animated Death of Superman, Superman Doomsday. But yeah, if you really like the Teen Titan movies and in that series, when you're done going through the movies, check out Young Justice. It's an animated show that they did. The first season is a lot more kid friendly, but it gets darker with each season and more adult, and like the themes and things that they cover, because it's not exactly Teen Titans. It's basically the Young Justice group is all the sidekicks get together and they kind of become the Justice League's like secret psyops group. So like they're the ones that go on the unofficial missions and stuff. And especially like second season on, they get real, real dark with like what that means and what comes with that, you know. And they incorporate a lot of cool stuff. They have I think it was third season, they incorporate the Batman Incorporated plot where Batman's basically like, fuck the Justice League, I'm starting my own, you know, thing, and it's just all the Bat family and it's called Batman Inc. Because of course, you know, he has to write off the taxes on it. That's what billionaires do. They find some bullshit reason to not pay taxes.
Bruce Wayne and his loopholes.
You know that fucker ain't paying taxes.
Oh, no, he ain't. In fact, it's funny in that this is a spoiler for the Harley Quinn animated series. But okay, spoiler alert for season 3. Basically, Bruce Wayne gets arrested for tax evasion because he was allocating so much of his money into Batman stuff.
Didn't Harley call him out too? Like when she found out he was Batman, she's
yeah.
Like, couldn't you have put this money into public programs and healthcare? And he's just like, because like, yeah, Batman's a total himbo in that, right?
Kind of. I mean, he's still Batman and pretty effective, but you know, they do kind of poke fun at him.
Oh man, they dropped the fourth season of Harley Quinn on Max with like no fanfare at all.
Yeah, I saw some ads for it, but it was just, and I hope more people are watching it too, because like this show's just been getting better and better, and this new season's been really good, where Harley Quinn actually joins the Bat family, and Poison Ivy is in charge of the Legion of Doom, and shenanigans ensue.
Yeah, the Valentine's Day special was...
Oh man, that was something.
That was so silly.
Yeah, I still love James Adomian as Bane.
Yeah, that's Lindsay's favorite part.
Oh, of course.
It's like the only animated show I've been able to get her into.
And now let's bring in this episode's guest. We've got Matt Orenstein, the composer of the upcoming movie Belle. How you doing, Matt?
I'm doing great, Jay. Great to be here.
Thanks for joining us this morning. The question I like to start with everybody is, how did you get started in your composing career?
How did I get started? I've been playing music since I was four. I started with violin. I hated it. One day I said to my teacher, this will be my last lesson. And so it was. I think I was also four when that happened. I took piano, you know, from the time I was six to the time I was 13, picked up the bass somewhere in there. And from there on in, I've been smitten with the bass. I went to school as a bass player. My in with music is being a bass player. You know, at orchestra rehearsals, I would always pay extra attention when we would stop the orchestra and listen to when the conductor would rehearse the different sections. I would try and pay attention and think, okay, how is this put together? Because I've always been listening to music. As far as movie scores, when I saw The Sixth Sense, it kept me up for 2 weeks. Not particularly because of the visuals, though those were pretty crazy to a 12-year-old or however old I was. I think I was 10. It was the music that did it. I remember that sort of buzzing score whenever Cole would see dead people. And then the feeling of that jump scare, and that never really left me. And I guess I'd sort of been chasing that for most of my life. When I got to college, I went in as a performance major, but I realized I wanted to do something a little different. So I talked to the conservatory where I went, and they allowed me to do a score for the Cabinet of Dr. Caligari as my final project. So I scored that. And then when I moved to Chicago, I was working as a theater composer, record store clerk, music teacher, moonlighting as a bass player. And then I got a couple of film gigs that I really liked. And my work in theater, with theater companies, with dance companies, the more I did it, the more I realized I really like composing for something that you can see. And I had to move out to LA. So I moved out here in 2016. And within a year, I reconnected with my old friend, Max Gold, who is the director of Belle. And he and I have been working together ever since.
When you say bass, you're talking the orchestral bass, though, not...
Oh, yeah.
Punk rock bass guitar. Okay.
I mean, I started as a punk rock bass guitarist. Okay. And I love that. Love it. Yeah. But yeah, I'm trained as an upright bass player in classical and jazz. Yeah.
Get one that can do both, you know, both the classical upstanding bass and the punk rock bass.
Oh yeah. Yeah. It's fun. Yeah.
And what was your first project with Max, or how did he first approach you on it?
We worked together on his first feature called Silicon Beach. We reconnected when I moved here. We had sort of, you know, we kept track of each other, but hadn't really talked as much in the years between high school and us moving out here. But we reconnected and he showed me a script. And the next thing you know, I'm working on this feature that he's making. And it was awesome. It was so fun. Yeah. Not really much of a story there. We just, you know, kind of reconnected at the right time and started working together.
Let's talk a little bit about Belle.
Yes.
The score for Belle, what is your process like? It sounds to me like it's like most of it's synthesized. Is it actually a synthesizer, or did you use an orchestra for it?
No orchestra. All sample. Okay. instruments and analog synths.
Even now, the violin parts, were those synthesized, or did you play those because you started with a violin?
No, I didn't play the violin parts. There's a viola solo in the middle of the movie that my friend Yvette played, and I played a lot of the upright bass parts, some of which you can't really tell are upright bass parts. There's some weird upright bass techniques that I'm using to sort of sweeten the score a little bit. And then on the suite at the very end, during the end credits, Max's dad plays the jazz bass solo. Max's dad was one of my first teachers, and he's great. Yeah.
So what is your process like when you're from script to final score? How do you compose? How do you do it?
Yeah. I read the script. I get some initial impressions and I talk to the director. And then the big thing about my process for this one was I actually went to Iceland, because when I was talking to Max, he said, if you really want to do this movie, there's a feeling that Iceland has that I'm trying to convey, and you can't convey it unless you've got it in your bones. So I don't care if you like get off the plane and then get right back on, as long as you just like, and then, you know, breathe in the air. I want you to have that feeling. So I went to Iceland. My process was I walked around with an iPhone, like recording wind sounds, because apparently there wasn't, you know, I talked to the sound recordist and I said, I'd like to record some nature sounds, incorporate them into the score. And he just said, you know, it's mostly wind out here. So I went to a couple of shoot days where my directive was mostly to stay hidden and explore. And so I did. I, you know, when we were in the cave where Bell and Beast were, you know, there's some action that happens with, there's some stuff that happens with Bell and Beast. It's where Beast lives. And so it's where she's for a bit. I went to that cave. The cave was like built into the side of a mountain. So I walked up that mountain. The sun was out at 10 PM. It was crazy. There was like what looked like an undisturbed Druid prayer circle. It was these very unnaturally flat stones at the top. It was crazy. But just like seeing stuff like that, it wasn't an ethnomusicological mission by a long shot. It was just, I wanted to go to Iceland. I wanted to see what it felt like. And I wanted to convey that through score. And then once I did that, I didn't write a note until I got footage. You know, and after I had talked temp with Max and our editor Patrick, you know, then, you know, took us a few drafts of the score to really get it, but at the end we really dialed it in,
and it was very successful in capturing that. Wasn't until I did looking into it after the movie that did I realize, oh, this was an American production that shot in Iceland. It really felt like that feeling of the authenticity, there we go, of the cool area. Yeah.
Movies that shoot in Iceland always look to me almost like tourism advertisements for Iceland, because it's such a beautiful country, like Lamb or Boca or
are you that Viking boat tours?
Yeah,
remember that
Valhalla Rising?
It was like an infomercial that was floating around for a while.
Oh,
I thought you were talking about a movie about a Viking boat tour.
No. I was talking about like there was an actual infomercial for like Viking cruise boat tours around Iceland and Norway.
I don't know why I thought Viking boat tour. Yeah, Valhalla Rising. That's definitely the plot of that movie.
I love that. The movie's great.
It's so
good. We all love that movie. It kind of figured into Norway. Yeah.
And on the subject, how did Max pitch you on the idea of this version of Beauty and the Beast?
Max had been working on some version of this movie for a very long time. And so I knew it was in the pipeline for him. I knew it was something he really, really, really wanted to do, even as we worked on Silicon Beach. And then there was a pilot. There was a project called Surfer's Paradise that we worked on together. It's more sci-fi, but I always knew that, I think we both knew that Belle was something that was a big dream. That was something that he really wanted to happen, I think. And I thought he was going to go with an Icelandic composer. So I read a bunch of drafts of the scripts and I weighed in as, you know, a friend and collaborator. And then one day I was like, so who are you getting in Iceland? Who do you have your eye on? He was like, well, I was thinking you'd do it. So that was the pitch. Just like, you would do it. And then when, you know, when Max says that, I say, okay, I'm doing it. Yeah.
Going back to what you're saying about incorporating the wind or the natural sound into the score, I noticed some of that in the score, and I was wondering if that was sound design or score, because it's the whole score is kind of ethereal, you know. It's and there were times when I was like, okay, wait, is that sound effect or is that part of this? Because there is like a pitch to it, there's a note to it, but it's almost like this ambient buzz more than it is an actual vamp. Mm-hmm. So was that the point of that, you know, of incorporating the natural sounds into it, just to kind of make it almost almost sound design instead of score?
Yeah, I mean, I think ideally they sort of meld, you know. It's all of a piece. Score, picture, sound design, like the score is just a part of, it's just a piece of the puzzle. Every synth patch I had, I would, you know, throw a little bit of noise on there. Every string patch I would design, or every sample instrument, I would try to, if there was a way to make it sound like there was just a little bit more bow hair, I would do that. When I would play my bass parts, whether it was the artificial harmonic drones that you hear throughout the score or the bass solos, I would loosen the bow hair when I bowed. And the effect that that has is you hear that kind of grit. It sounds more like a viola da gamba or something like that, which is a, you know, an early, you know, an earlier Baroque instrument where you control the, at least the bass gamba, I don't know about the viola, you control the tension of the bow with your hand. And the roughness, the sort of layer of white noise above it is a kind of dynamic in and of itself.
Most people know Beauty and the Beast, obviously, from the Disney musical. Was there pressure to, how do I say this? The music from that is so well known. Mm-hmm. Did you consciously step away? It's a very different movie, so you may not have had to do this, but did you consciously step away from that, you know, to make sure that it sounded completely different, or was it just because the movie called for something completely different?
The movie called for something completely different, so I didn't have to step. I didn't really have to step anywhere that I wasn't being kind of direct, anywhere that A, I wasn't being directed to go, and B, that I didn't think I needed to go. I mean, we're all on the same page. I think, yeah, I think, I don't know if the Disney version came up. I mean, it's just sort of one of those things, like, we've all seen it. We all lived it. We all know, right. Be Our Guest.
Not doing that.
We're not doing that.
Okay.
Talk more about La Belle and La Bête, the Cocteau version.
That's what I was going to ask. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah, we're huge fans of that. I've only seen it the one time. I saw it in high school. My dad and my uncle went halvesies on that old Janus box set of 50 movies. You remember that?
Oh.
Yeah. And so we just had that in the house when I was a senior in high school and when I would come home from college. And I just popped that in one day and I was like, whoa, this is freaky. I like this. Yeah. Max and I are both Bergman fans. So that was more, I mean, the tone of his stuff was something that he and I talked about, and I don't know if it really made it into, I don't know how much of an influence it was directly on Belle, but it was something that, it was a common ground for both of us. So it was something that at least I was thinking about a little bit.
This is definitely not the Disney, Beauty and the Beast.
Yeah. Yeah, definitely.
One of the things I really liked about Belle is that it doesn't like flip flop between genres, but it's not afraid to one moment go into like a horror and then the next kind of be more of a romance. And then there's even like some comedic, was that a fun challenge, to be bouncing around between those moods and settings and, kind of feels with that while also keeping the consistency of the piece?
Yeah, I guess so. I mean, I wasn't really thinking too hard about it when I was writing the score. I think I was really, what I really wanted to do was have a kind of a musical language that could accommodate both, you know? I mean, cause actors can do both. Actors can do, you know, great actors can do anything. And oftentimes, you know, in a lot of movies, you'll see them kind of go back and forth and be a little more dynamic. So once we sort of figured out what instruments, what genres, what musical conventions could have room for both romance and horror. And then horror to comedy is not much of a stretch.
Duh. It's the same setup, just different punchline.
Yeah.
We discuss that a lot.
Yeah. Have you seen just as a aside, have you seen the recut trailer to The Shining as a comedy?
Oh, yeah. Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. The horror Mrs. Doubtfire.
Yeah. Yep. Oh, yeah.
That's the difference. Yeah. We wanted something that was pretty limber and could move between romance and horror on a dime. I think there's emotionally, there's a lot of carryover too. I mean, just look at Wuthering Heights, you know? I mean, that goes from romance to straight up like grave robbing, very, you know, in the matter of pages.
Or something like Bones and All.
Oh, right? Oh God. That was a crazy movie.
Yeah.
Crazy. Wow.
Especially for Jay, he didn't know anything going into that. So
yeah, I purposely avoid any kind of trailers or anything. So that first scene, I was just like, oh my God, this movie, you know,
you could almost see the smell rising off.
Oh yeah.
That's a horrible way to describe it, but very accurate.
No,
very
worst
accurate.
Way would be finger licking good. which I took from Shocker with Horace Pinker. Remember he did that bit?
Yeah, that's
Wes really tried to create another Freddy with Shocker, didn't he?
Yep. Can you imagine 7 Shocker movies?
I kind of wish that did happen, to be honest.
Yeah, don't we all? Back at it with Bell. How did you approach the music when it came to the characters?
So Papa was, I kind of, when I work on a score, this is probably, you know, something that is true to my process. A lot of the times I'll start wherever I can get a foothold. And in this case, I was chipping away at the edges before I really got into Bell's theme. Before that was the last thing I composed. The first character that I composed for was Papa. Papa, I felt, was pretty easy. It was pretty clear cut. He's very traditional, you know, an aging man, has his kind of ideas about what his daughter should be, what he should be to his daughter. I felt like a sort of regal, traditionally regal sounding, proud sounding soundscape was what he deserved. Beast, I went about, the theme just sort of came out. I was making a bunch of kind of bestial sounds with all the string patches, you know, all the sample instruments and synthesizers. And then I just played this melody on the Prophet, which is a pretty cool synth. And it sounded, you know, I hung out with Inge on the way to the cave. He drove me. So we spent a couple hours in the car together. We got to know each other a little bit. And I feel like that kind of, I played that theme and immediately Max was like, that's it. That's Beast. It's this melancholy sort of regal theme. Again, regal because Beast is a, you know, a prince. Yeah. Who gets cursed and falls very far. So I think we both felt like the theme adequately captured that. Bell was a challenge, I should say. We tried a bunch of stuff and, you know, what we settled on was something that was kind of like a lullaby, I guess. Sort of, it happens in her private moments when you hear the voice of her, when you hear the voice of her mother. And then finally the theme crystallizes. And I feel like the way that we treat it sort of sums up Belle's journey. It's one of, I don't want to get too much into what her journey is, but I feel like the theme tracks her progress the times that it appears. But I listened to a bunch of stuff. I mean, I was listening a lot to the Bulgarian Women's Choir. I was listening to that Bjork record, Medulla, which is awesome. You know that one?
It's so good. Yeah.
It's one of my favorites. But just a lot of choral music, a lot of, you know, a few, you know, Icelandic melodies here and there. And that's what came out at the very end. I think I don't remember. It was very, very close to the finish line. It wasn't quite at the 1 yard line, but it wasn't that far off. Yeah. You know? And then Witch, you know, the Witch's soundscape is more feral, but it's still sensual, still alluring. Because the witch has this sort of animal magnetism to her, this pull, but there's a wildness, and I wanted to convey that. So a lot of hand-built software instruments, a lot of weird percussion, sort of off-kilter vocals, you know. Yeah. All right, that's too granular.
Never too granular. We love getting into the nitty-gritty, especially the inspirations. Like,
yeah.
Love a good Bjork reference.
Oh, I can't have too much Bjork.
She's all, her influence is all over the score.
Oh, that's awesome. Yeah. I still say that she wasn't casted in The Northman. She just showed up one day and they were like, oh, shit. Yeah, go ahead. Like, that
Robert
was
Eggers is like, hey.
Oh, yeah. Cool. We've been needing this part filled. Yeah. And you're already in costume. Costume? You're right. You're right. Yeah.
Yeah, she's one of my heroes. I love her.
Especially like interviews with like the famous one where she's talking about her TV and like going through like the circuits and stuff. It's just like, it's so it's genius. It's just, I love when artists talk about like the intricacies of just like the simple everyday life out items. Her and David Byrne are really good at that.
Yeah. Yeah.
And Belle comes out actually tomorrow. Well, when this episode comes out on the 22nd, which is tomorrow on VOD. But you have another project that's coming out soon as well.
Yeah, I scored a movie, a very different movie called Daddy, that's going to be at Cinequest. It's going to be at the Hammer Theater in downtown San Jose as part of Cinequest. Very different movie, but I'm proud of this one as well. Yeah. And then other than that, you know, I'm just mixing artists' records and producing artists' records and playing on other people's records. And there's a couple film, there's one or two film things in the pipeline, but not much happening right now. So
whose records are you playing on?
I'm producing my friend Sarah Melson's record. And she's done some cool stuff. And we're working on something really cool right now. But yeah, I mean, other than that, just people around LA.
Do you do a lot of session work, and is it the bass that you play, or what?
The bass that I play, yeah.
Okay. And do you do a lot of session work around there?
Trying to do more. Yeah. Always trying to do more. I mean, composing is the first love for sure, or composing is the main thing, but I love playing bass, and being a bass player is not much different than being a film composer. You show up, you're a part of a team. You try to make the project better and not outsize whatever it is you're doing. And like a good bass player, if you're missing a good film score, you really miss it.
It's one of those things that you don't notice it's not there until it's not there. It's like you may not notice it when it is there, but when it's gone, you're like, I remember hearing about test screenings of Halloween without the score. People thought it was a comedy. And then you add the score and you're like, holy crap, this is terrifying.
Yeah.
It does make all the difference.
Yeah.
Yeah.
That's completely understandable. I'm giving notes right now on a documentary piece supposed to cut 20 minutes, and I'm sitting there and there's no score. And I'm like, everything feels so boring. It's just talking heads and there's no action. Yeah. All right. I just got to remember the music will be added later. It'll be more interesting with music. Just focus on what's being said.
Yeah. Yeah.
All right. Well, thanks for joining us here today, Matt. Is there anything else you got coming up that you can talk about, or just we already covered what you got coming up?
You covered what I've got. You covered. Yeah.
Where can people find you on the socials to kind of keep up with what you've got coming up as it comes up?
My website is mattorenstein.com. Twitter is Matt Orenstein, but the O is a zero. And Instagram, Matt_Orenstein.
Did somebody have Matt Orenstein with a regular O, or did you do that just on purpose?
Yeah, no, there's another Matt. There are many Matt Orensteins. There's like a hockey player, an old hockey player from Hofstra. I think there's another Matt Orenstein in Hollywood who does something different than I do. There's definitely Matt Orensteins around. Yeah.
There's a Jay Edwards who worked on Adult Swim, I think it is.
Uh-huh.
So
yeah.
So there are other people with your names, unfortunately.
Yeah. Well, there's I follow the Minnesota Timberwolves, the basketball team that's been sort of woefully mismanaged as long as they've been in existence. And the beat writer for, I think, The Athletic for the Wolves is John Krasinski. So That's confusing.
But not that John Krasinski.
Not Jim. Yeah.
Yeah.
Well, thanks for joining us this morning. Everybody, go see Bell on Bell. It's VOD starting tomorrow. If you listen to this the day it's released, hopefully all VOD platforms. You know, I'm sure you'll be able to find it somewhere. To if you want to find us, Ion Horror, we're on all the socials at Ion Horror, or you can go to ihorror.com, which is the site we all call home. Our theme song is by Restless Spirit, so go give them a listen. Hey, Restless Spirit is coming to the West Coast
on tour.
That is exciting. They're coming to LA. It's a Tuesday. I'm hoping I can come up for it.
You're going to come up to LA for it?
I'm going to try.
Oh, shit.
It's a Tuesday, which is traditionally a pretty light work day for me, so it might be looking good. Our artwork is by Chris Fisher, so give him a like. And we will see you again in a couple of weeks. So for me, James J. Edwards.
I'm Jacob Davison.
I'm Jonathan Correa.
I'm Matt Orenstein.
Keep your eye on horror.